it is amazing how fast it goes. So hang on. It's quite a ride if you do it right. It's a real honor to be here with each and every one of you. Dean, it is an honor to be here with you. And I want to thank you for your help in this, you know, many of the ideas that we're going to be sort of putting out here today. Mitch has helped us to shape. And along with other deans at schools like this around the country, they have been a wonderful kitchen cabinet, if you will, in helping advise and inform me as we seek to find the best way so that we don't violate rule number one, which is don't do any damage, you know, don't muck it up worse than what it was when you got there. And I think that's an important one. To Ann Wicks, who has been my host all day. Ann, thank you so much for the hospitality and the incredible day that you've given us, and to all the faculty who have spent today sharing their ideas and thoughts with me and their willingness to work with us in the future. I look forward to tomorrow to hopefully getting to meet in a more a smaller setting than this room with each of you at the students, both here at the graduate school and at the undergraduate school. I want to introduce three folks who also graduated from Maxwell who, when I got this job, when the president called me up and lured me away from the zoo, he gave me the privilege, which he didn't give to many, which was allowed me to assemble my own team. So I set about trying to find the best and the brightest people that I could. I'm very honored that each one of them, when I sat down with them and begged them to join me in this effort, they all quickly said yes. And first is Tanya Shand, my Director of Congressional Relations. She has a distinguished career on Capitol Hill in the House of Representatives, but is really leading change at the Office of Personnel Management. Next to her is John Foley and John O'Brien, who the three of us actually lived together when we were here at Syracuse. So people used to call and say, is John there? And we'd say, get serious, you know. People in our class called us John Cubed. They specialized in health policy while I was here and then have spent the next 25 years working in that profession. And as you may or may not know, OPM is responsible for managing the second largest health plan in the United States. We have 9 million members in our employees' health benefits program. And I knew nothing about it. And so I said, boy, this is an issue. If we're going to be part of the president's overall health reform, if we're going to protect federal employees, we got to get the best and the brightest. And luckily, both of them surrendered their positions and joined the federal team at OPM. When I was your age, sitting here, Professor Scotty Campbell had just returned from creating the Office of Personnel Management in Washington and serving as its first leader during the Carter administration. It is one thing for a professor to rise to this position, but it is quite another, I would argue, for a student. As a boy from Rockville, Maryland, I never imagined that I would be called by the President of the United States and given the chance to carry the Maxwell flag to OPM once more. This is all the more special because I believe this is a very historic opportunity for comprehensive reform of our civil service system. I think the stars are aligned in a way that occurs probably only once in a generation. We have a president who deeply values service and wants to restore the dignity and respect for our civil service to what it was during President Kennedy's stirring call. We have a Congress that is willing to help, and a public that increasingly recognizes that our current approaches to hiring, rewarding, appraising, and training our employees is inadequate. The United States Civil Service is an elite core of dedicated professionals that are heirs to a proud tradition. Led by the President of the United States, our service to our country and humanity spans the globe. The story of the U.S. Civil Service reaches back two centuries and touches every field of human endeavor. From arresting the likes of Al Capone to walking on the moon, Elliot Ness and Neil Armstrong were both GS employees, as were environmentalists Rachel Carson and Bob Stanton, my friend and the first African American to lead the National Park Service. Federal workers like these are the people who brought you the lunar landing, who rebuilt the world after war, who cure disease, fight crime, protect our Constitution, and advance our civilization. Without them, all is lost. With you, all is possible. We need you and your talents, your passion, and your creativity if government is to work. And let me tell you who you'll be joining. Unsung heroes who quietly go about the business of making the United States a nation where we can drink the water, breathe the air, and travel safely. In most instances, our citizens go about their daily lives unaware of the work of these civil servants and the risks that they take. And yet, since 1995, just since 1995, 2,186 people have made the supreme sacrifice of their lives in the civil service on behalf of their neighbors and their country. They didn't work for recognition. They know the value of their mission, and they know the nobility of service. However, there is an increasing risk that the nation will not be able to continue to attract and retain the best and the brightest employees who have made this nation what it is today. The very procedures that were supposed to ensure that job applicants are evaluated based on merit are discouraging applicants from completing the arduous quest of actually getting a civil service job. We must make changes now if we are to maintain the quality of our civil service. And we've got a lot of work to do. First, we must end the denigration of our civil servants and stop using them as political footballs. For 30 years, public servants have been denigrated and maligned by both political parties. These attacks weren't only misguided, they were dead wrong. Civil servants are every bit as efficient as the private sector, if not more so. Their integrity and their dedication are unsurpassed. And to honor their service, we have principles that cannot be compromised. Today, I'm going to be focusing primarily on one, our core principle, merit. It's time to reinvigorate merit for the 21st century. In my opinion, there is a lot of entrepreneurial energy in America, a lot of dynamism, so many people who are hungry for a challenge and an opportunity to meet it. If you're one of those smart, ambitious people and you come into a well-run company and show leadership potential, you'll end up on a fast track in most cases. They'll send you to management trainee programs. They'll promote you, give you bonuses, and in return, hopefully you'll work harder. And from your new higher position, your hard work will pay off. The company succeeds, everybody wins. In the government, sadly, too often you'll run into a human resources system and a culture that favors, quite frankly, red tape and inertia over initiative. You'll find that a lot of extra effort may get you a little more reward, but not that much. So you'll get disheartened. You'll either settle for the slower pace or you'll get restless and leave. And if that happens, everybody loses. We can do better. We have to empower our workers and channel their energy into solving our problems. We have an economy to rebuild, two wars to support, crumbling infrastructure to repair, a pandemic flu to stop, and a planet in peril from climate change. We need to get the best people into the federal government, and once they're here, we need to get them into the right places. We need to build that eye for talent that elevates the wheat and tosses out the chaff. In a growing company, that can be done by one or a few people. And the success or failure of the company depends largely on their ability to identify, hire, and promote talented people. We have 1.9 million employees in the federal government. We hire 300,000 employees a year, give or take. One set of eyes can't do it. We need systems, and we need them urgently. I believe deeply in public service. I had my dream job running the National Zoo, but I left it to serve the people who serve America because, quite frankly, public servants are and have always been my heroes. We are a very strong professional public service, and this shows in the smooth transition of power from one president to the next, which we take for granted. We do not need to be reinvented, but we do need to reinvigorate and unshackle our best resource, our people. Our hiring system is quite frankly broken. 5 decades after the last major attempt at pay reform, the cracks are showing. A significant and growing number of our employees are not in the general service pay system. This system cannot stand another 3 decades, let alone 5. Now, I don't mean to say it's going to crash tomorrow. We could limp along for a few more years under the current GS system. Or I would argue we can seize this moment to build something entirely new. The central question I ask all of you today is, how do we practice the principle of merit in the 21st century? Let me add some sub-questions to that to inform that discussion. The central questions that I want your help on, I'm going to lay out. And then I'm going to give you some thoughts about my own, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. And since I don't have anywhere to go but the Sheraton across the street, I'm happy to stay as long as you want. How do we define and appraise merit today? How do we make our system flexible enough to let the best workers and managers run as fast and as far as their talent and drive can take them, but fair enough to keep the system from running amok? How do we motivate and reward good performance and address poor performance without cronyism or favoritism? How do we train, educate, and develop workers over the course of their careers to make the most of their abilities? Those are the 4 questions I propose. I don't pretend to have the answers, and that's why I'm searching far and wide, discussing these issues not only with professionals at OPM, and with government agencies, but with academics and students like you, our labor unions, and some of America's most innovative private sector employees and employers as well. Last week, my staff and I participated in a roundtable discussion in Washington with leaders from all of these different groups. We were there to listen, and what we heard clearly from them is that our people are our first asset. They are an investment, not a cost. And we need to get back to treating them that way. I hate the term human capital. I think it is demeaning as a term. I think it implies that people are widgets. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care how much technology you have. If you don't have the right people, you can't build anything. And so I think it's people aren't a piece of the equation. People are the equation. And that's why our government in the 21st century has got to wrestle with and solve these issues. That roundtable and events like this are only the beginning. We've got a long way to go in developing this initiative, and I need your help. So now that we've laid out the initial questions, let me discuss what I think might be the basis for 4 pillars of civil service reform before we go to discussion. So let's go back to the questions. First, how do we define and appraise merit today? How has revolutionary change in the world around us defined merit in the federal workplace? Let me give you some background. Our nation's needs have changed dramatically over the last 125 years. Our civil service has obviously changed with it. Our nation has grown, and the sum of human knowledge has grown with it. And the complexity of the tasks we're facing has grown in tandem. A century ago, merit might have meant that a worker flawlessly hand-copied documents or typed 100 words per minute, and that competency might be all that was required over the course of their career. Not anymore. Now, I'm not here to philosophize about the proper size of government. That's not my role. But it is a simple fact that 125 years ago, there were no nuclear power, pharmaceutical, telecommunications, or financial derivatives industries. And if Enron didn't destroy the notion that these businesses could police themselves, surely the events of the last 2 years have. Our federal workforce today needs people who can understand all the aspects of our rapidly evolving economy, provide expert advice to our elected and appointed officials, and serve not only as cops on the beat, faithfully executing our laws, but also protecting the American people. The 21st century definition of merit needs to be geared to them. It must assess critical thinking and problem-solving skills. It must assess how well a worker has kept up with changes in his or her field and contributions that they have made to the field beyond their immediate job requirements. Shouldn't a good appraisal system evaluate the whole worker and do so over the entire course of their career? Instead of maybe meticulously parsed grades and steps, maybe we should consider career ladders with just three stages: apprentice, journey level, expert. And what if we drew bright lines between those stages and had a high bar to get from one to another, a performance review board, not just of your supervisors, but of your peers and outside professionals who would determine, are you ready to go to that next step? Would having your rank follow you no matter what job you're doing, instead of having it tied to a specific position, be more appropriate in the 21st century? What if you could go from one job to the next at the level you belong without the HR staff needing to shoehorn a justification for it? Maybe such a three-stage system could help ensure that we're promoting the best people, and it would take also some of the pressure, because right now most of the merit pressure is focused on the hiring decision, because our managers feel, oh my God, we're hiring this person, they have tenure for life. If we screw this up, we're stuck for life. So it puts too much of a burden on the front. If we spread that concept of review throughout a person's career, we can take some of the pressure off the front end. Now, we don't want hiring managers to have that paralysis. Maybe the entire apprentice stage is probationary. Or maybe the probationary period is shorter, but we would instead require an affirmative step to keep someone on at the end of that probation instead of what we do now, which is after 1 year, you're automatically tenured. So we have the concept of setting a high bar at the beginning of each of these three stages: apprentice, journey level, and expert. What might that bar look like? For me, the three most important qualities are fairness, comprehensiveness, and transparency. Fairness means that we build workable standards, apply them uniformly, hear all voices, and do not leave ultimate decisions at one person's discretion. Comprehensiveness means that we look at the entire breadth of your professional contributions, both inside and outside of office. What training courses have you taken? Where have you been published or presented? What seminars have you gone to? Who have you mentored or recruited? What volunteer work have you done? Pro bono does not have to be only for lawyers. We can't be so zealous in avoiding irrelevant factors that we neglect to look at the whole person. Now, transparency means the promotion process and criteria are clearly spelled out for people and the results explained. Transparency is key to getting buy-in from workers and from the public. One possible way to achieve these goals might be through those performance review boards, composed by colleagues from fields, managers, labor representatives, even maybe members of the public. What if the boards could review personnel files, do their own research and listening, and reach independent judgments that would have to be accepted by all stakeholders? their operation could reinforce the underlying principle that seniority may, but does not always equal, merit. Next pillar, flexibility. How do we give our people room to run, but not to run amok? One thing I think we need to consider is a results-only work environment, or ROWE, grow. That is what they did at Best Buy. Many of you might be familiar with that work. The people who did that wrote a book called Work Sucks. And the basic premise of it is that you throw out the time clock, you unchain people from their desks, and you say, we don't care where or when or how you work, as long as you get the job we've told you we want done, done. Why can't we let folks pick up their kids from school and finish their work once the kids are in bed? Have you ever been in a government office when it shuts down midday for snow? Some of you might be interns or come from the government. You're familiar with this. I remember one time the announcement went out about 3 o'clock that we were shutting down, and you never saw people so happy. And they weren't happy because they hated their jobs. They were happy to be freed from the rigid time clock. In a row system, it's just the opposite of that. It would treat our employees like responsible adults. And if we do it right, with proper training for workers and managers, and flexibilities like telework and alternative work schedules built in, I would argue I think it might boost morale, increase productivity, and deliver good value to the taxpayer. Switching gears, another idea for increasing flexibility, might be entirely eliminating the classification system. The system that parses the grades and steps that we now have and attempts to define every job in minute detail. The classification system was designed in the 19th century for a noble purpose, to ensure equal pay for equal work. And that is a core value to which, of course, we must continue to pay great deference. But when it prevents managers from adapting their job responsibilities to the ever-shifting responsibilities of their departments, it becomes a millstone. And classification today has become so stilted, our HR staffers have become so used to manipulating it, that in the words of one of them, a good classifier could make a Dixie cup a GS-14. Classification today is not protecting the equal pay principle, but it is taking up a lot of time, and it is limiting our flexibility to define jobs properly and promote the best people quickly. So maybe we should just scrap it entirely. Now, I spoke a few minutes ago about the high bar to get from stage to stage, from apprentice to journey level to expert. But what about when you're within the stage? What happens in between those big promotion reviews? A lot of people, in fact, are going to retire at the journey level after a very long and fulfilling career. Not everyone is going to want to become an expert. And so they'll only really face that promotion board once in their career. As will some people with advanced degrees and extensive qualifications who might enter government at the journey level, or maybe even the expert level. How do we motivate and reward good performance and address poor performance? This is not an easy nut to crack. I don't think anyone, public sector or private sector, would come up to you and stand here and say, we have nailed performance appraisal. Here's the solution. Parents don't like to go home and tell their kids when they're messing up. Why do we expect they're going to be able to do it as managers in the workplace? But we're going to try to take a shot at this. Building a new performance appraisal system, getting agency, manager, and worker buy-in, and backing it with the training and resources it needs to succeed will pay huge dividends now and very far into the future. What if managers and employees had to define at the beginning of the year 3 must-do items and 3 nice-to-do items for each job and each person? What if managers were actually given training on how to have difficult conversations in the workplace? What if we mandated a 6-month and year-end review where the employee was clearly told whether they were in one of 3 categories, in good standing, for 80 to 90% of workers who were doing a solid job. Outstanding for the 5 to 10% who have really helped move the ball on achieving core agency mission and results. And then finally, not in good standing for the 5% of workers who are in need of improvement or removal. Now that would replace the existing 5 measurements we currently use, which are outstanding, more than fully successful, less than fully successful, or unsuccessful. Well, the reality is, if 80% of your employees are in that middle category, and they're doing a good job, and they're showing up for work on time, and they've got a great attitude in the workplace, and having been a manager and having to do this, it is very hard to sit down and tell somebody, you're fully successful. Now, as the dean was mentioning, I was a 4.0 student. If somebody told me I was fully successful, I'd quit. Because don't kid me, I know you're talking, I'm either C, C plus, or C minus. So what you end up with is, in our current appraisal system, is you demoralize 80% of your workforce every year. You panic managers who don't want to have that conversation in the first place, because all they want to do is thank them for doing a good job and pat them on the back, give them their COLA, and get them out of their office quickly. Well, let's do that so that managers can focus on the ends of the spectrum where managers need to focus, rewarding superstars and disciplining and helping those employees that need it. At the end of it, we need to build a timely appeals process that ensures fairness. What if we modeled that on the jury system with a panel of representatives made up of labor, management, and other stakeholder groups that would review your file, hear your case, and give you a quick decision? But frivolous complainers, beware, because how about if this panel not only can take you up, they can take you down. And managers, beware, because what if we empower that jury panel to also discipline and remove managers who aren't doing their job correctly? As much as we wish it weren't so, in any organization with 1.9 million employees, there are going to be a few bad apples, and it should not take years to fire one of them. The decision to fire someone, don't get me wrong, has to be fair and the reasons have to be clear. It ought to be reviewed because the power to take away someone's livelihood, quite frankly, shouldn't rest in one person's hands. But we have to think of other workers too. Nobody likes to carry dead weight, and nobody should have to. I've had a couple of times in my career where I've had to fire people who weren't doing the job. It wasn't easy, but afterwards, it was the co-workers who came up and thanked me for showing the backbone to take the action I did. So we fire people when we have to, but only as a last resort. First, we want to try giving them training and support to see if that helps. But right now, our managers only have one stick, one hammer in the toolbox, which is the threat of removal. And since everybody knows it's so hard to use, it's rarely, if ever, taken out of the toolbox. We need to give managers more tools in that box. What if they could pull a stick to slap you upside the head and say, you're losing a couple weeks annual leave. You're losing your within grade. You're losing your COLA. Now you give the manager gradations that they can send a signal to you, I am not happy with your performance. Get into line. I want you to be in good standing. You are not in good standing. And ultimately, if people don't get the message, to have the ability to fire. That's on the disciplinary end. What about the reward end? It can't all be about discipline because, in fact, point of fact, I think there are far less employees in need of discipline than there are in need of reward. We have many outstanding people in the federal government. They do amazing things, miracles, every day. If you're in the senior executive service, one of 2,000 people, you're eligible to compete for a bonus system that is 10, 20, and 30% of your pay. Now, I'm not real good with numbers, but 30% of $177,000 is a lot of money. And that's a real incentive for the senior executive service. If you're in the GS schedule, what do you get? 3 to 5%. Yet your miracle may be just and every bit as significant as the SES. We ought to have the same system for everybody. And what if we gave our managers the ability up to 5% for bonuses, But we create a 10, 20, 30% category for all workers, not just the SES. And we allow people to nominate their coworkers. Your supervisor could nominate you too. In fact, you could nominate yourself. And it'll go to a performance review board that will assess it, rank it, and decide who wins and who loses. And whatever they conclude, it would be published. It'd be public. It'd be completely transparent. So now, right now, most workers feel that people are getting bonuses that they aren't. And so consequently, there's an enormous rumor mill in the federal government. It's like, why did they get it and I didn't? And even when people do get bonuses and it is accurate, no one tells them why they got it and they didn't. If we're giving somebody 30% of their salary, I think we ought to be willing to tell the taxpayer, this is why. If this person advanced a cure for cancer that's going to save millions of people, or came up with a process that's going to allow us to more quickly serve 3,000 disabled veterans a year, they deserve 30%, thank you very much. And we ought to be proud to give it to them. And we ought to be proud to defend that in any congressional district of the land. It's the transparency and the review that's got to give credibility to it that can sustain it, would be my opinion. Which brings me to the final pillar. You all have been very patient, and I know those seats aren't very comfortable, having sat in them myself. Training. The federal government does a pathetic job of it. The Defense Department is the only one that spends any money of note. It's shameful. Training is always the first thing to get cut from the budget, and it's the last thing to put back. I shudder to think how much productivity is lost and how much our work suffers while people struggle to teach themselves things that any other organization in the world would train them on. Performance management is a great example. In a way, training is the foundation on which all the previous three pillars that I've been discussing rest. Because we can devise the greatest system in the world, but if we don't train managers to manage in it, and we don't train workers to work in it, it will fail. So how do we invest in our workers to get the most back from them? Training should be both formal and ongoing. It means taking courses at institutes. It means funding education, continuing education, and college credits. It means working in partnership with universities across the land. It means dedicating a percentage of your budget to actual training so that it gets done, because right now it is not occurring. Let me also just end, obviously I'm here talking to students. Let me discuss very briefly, because I know the pain that you're going through under the PMF program and in applying for positions in the government. I was in the job for, well, actually, when the president called me, he said, John, I want you to make government cool again. And I told him, Mr. President, I just turned 50. I says, you know, by definition, do the opposite of what I say, and you're closer to cool. And so I've been wrestling with this, how are we going to make this cool again thing? And I was at a reception, and this young man came up, about the age of many of you in this room, and he started wagging his finger at me saying, I just had this, you know, intern experience with the Inspector General's office. It was a nightmare. They gave me the stack of papers. They put me in a windowless room. It was horrible. I was not supported. Nobody, the next nearest person was 40 people. I stayed 2 weeks and quit, got the heck out of there. You need to fix this. And I said, how would you like to fix this? And he said, well, I'm still in school. And I said, well, when do you get out? And he says, 6 weeks. And I said, I can wait 6 weeks. And so I hired this kid who just got his MBA from Stanford. And he has led a group of other students and brilliant people from across the government. And they have submitted a reform initiative that is going to totally overhaul our student program and our student hiring program. It's going to revitalize the Presidential Management Fellowship. We're going to try to go from 400 a year to 2,000. We're going to try to increase the grades that you'd be hired by. We're going to try to relieve your debt burden that many of you have had to assume to get through your graduate educations and, quite frankly, your undergraduate educations. And so we need to be about creating clear pathways that make sense so that if you want a summer internship, get on this path. You want a job after getting a bachelor's degree, you're on this path. You got a graduate degree, line up here. And so we're going to try to sort of clear away the clutter and make this as simple and as streamlined as we can, because we have got to bring you into this government. Over a third of our government is eligible to retire in the next 10 years. We've got to be able to replace it with the next generation of the best and the brightest. That is why I hope that we can achieve this, and I'm aiming to get it achieved before Christmas. We're also working to relieve the debt that we mentioned that you all have been talking about in building on the Sarbanes bill and the service requirement, but to lower some of the time frames. That will take legislation, so it won't be done by Christmas. But we're going to work to try to build as many incentives as we can so that serving your nation isn't as much of a burden as it otherwise could be. So those are some of my initial thoughts. At the core of this vision are principles that are moral truths. Applicants and employees should be judged on their ability to do the job and nothing else. Work of equal value should get equal reward, no matter who's doing it. By breathing new life into these truths, we breathe new life into our government, our nation, and the principles of America's founding. And even as our challenges evolve, the charge to each generation remains constant, so much so that we can find it in the annals of classical history. When the young of ancient Athens became adults, who were inducted to full citizenship, they swore an oath, one that you walk by each day, just as I did in 1980. An oath to transmit our nation, not only not less, but greater, richer, and more abundant than it was given to us. That is the task at hand. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. And I'm happy to take Q&A if you want. However you want to do it.
I think it's evident from Director Berry's speech that he's not planning to tinker at the margins. And he's raised a lot of interesting ideas in this presentation. We have other members of his staff here, also Maxwell alumni. The floor is open. There are mics here on the mezzanine level. And I encourage you all to use this opportunity for Q&A. Please just get up to the microphone so you can be heard.
You can
moderate yourself.
Oh, all right, great. That'd be easy.
Hi.
Hey.
Is that working?
All right.
Hi, okay. So the changes that you're going to be making to the PMF sound really amazing. So do the ones who applied this year, are we just out of luck?
You know, we're going to have to figure this out so that nobody loses under this. We're creating this to give a margin of error. So in each system, it would apply to when you graduate plus 2 years. And so you'd have this window of opportunity to get into competitive service without, through this competitive process, rather than having to go competing for a job. You always have the right to compete for a job. But, so that way we're trying to build a two-year window in for everybody. So that would also include and encompass your class.
Thank you.
And so we'll make sure we keep that flexibility for you. We'll go back and forth. Yes, sir.
Director Berry, thank you so much for being here today. My name is Andrew Leibowitz, and I was really interested in your discussion of how we can reshape the professional tracks, and especially perhaps the cross-pollination that managers could have from one department to another. And on that note, I'm interested in understanding two things. One, how are you going to create a culture for employees that, part of the ongoing education is kind of learning about how the functions of different agencies and perhaps different related branches they might move into operate, and what resources they have so that there can be a knowledge transfer and potentially better prepare people to move into those roles. And secondly, to your point about one-third of the civil service retiring, it makes me wonder where the mentors will be when we get there. And when we get there, will the mentors be prepared to act as mentors?
Thank you. It's a great question. It's something we're wrestling with. What we're working on now is a veterans hiring initiative, which I hope will launch by next Wednesday. Veterans Day, and then second, a recruitment and hiring reform initiative that we hope to get airborne by Christmas. And if we succeed in that, both of those will greatly help in that regard. We are going to try to have each of the SES have two for every university in the country. We're going to pair them with a group of student ambassador cadres that will be allow us to connect into each and every university. But to have the SES connection there that can talk to the deans and the faculty, along with the ambassadors, who can talk directly to you. And so that we'll have an ongoing relationship that's going to allow for that an appreciation for the recruitment that we have to do. We can't just passively post things on the website and hope people come to us. We need to get off that chair and get out and compete. And so we're going to be aggressively doing that through that approach and that model. But even more importantly, and I think you hit on it, it's a critical thing that we need to create and endorse and support is mentorship. And I have been pushing, there's been a lot of effort to bring retirees back in or to extend their stay in the federal government. And one of the things I've been arguing on Capitol Hill for is I'm willing to support that as long as 30% of their time is spent mentoring, so that there's a direct knowledge transfer and commitment of that person, either to the person who's going to fill their job or to the next generation who's needed to bring into government. And so I'm a big believer in mentorship. We're going to be approaching this from every angle we can. On the vet hiring initiative, how we're doing this is kind of fun, is we're going to be trying to get jobs for vets in domestic agencies where they've been mostly hired by DOD and VA. And in domestic agencies, one of the reasons they don't go there is because there's no support network for them. So what we're going to do is when they come in the door, we're going to assign them a mentor who works in that agency, who is a vet, who they can go to, like, what are these people thinking? Why do I do this? It is a very different culture from the military to civilian. I had to laugh. I visited the Coast Guard last week, and I had breakfast with Admiral Allen, who runs the Coast Guard. And so, we have breakfast at 7:30 promptly, which was a chore for me, being like a 9 o'clock in the morning guy. But I'm there. I was there on time. So he has a staff meeting. Starts at 8. And at like 10 seconds of 8, he says, okay, we stand up. We walk across the room. There's a room about as big as this, a huge table. Everybody, you see at this table, everybody's in the rows around this table. He walks in the room. They all stand up. He sits down. They sit down. They start the meeting. I said, I thought we had to laugh because I have a White House fellow who's with me who's from the Army. He knows, like, we have my staff meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm running down the hall saying, meeting starting! Come on, everybody! Get in here! Let's go! So very different culture, civilian and military. So we've got to build that bridge, that cross-section where people can get in and feel support. So we're going to have a mentor for them in the agency and one in DOD that they'll have two numbers to always call. So we're going to take this mentorship idea very seriously and try to put it in everything we do.
Thank you very much. I thought your speech was very interesting. And on the broad level, I guess I feel like, linking the performance with the money and making government more efficient and cutting red tape, on the broad level, it sounds very similar to what Clinton tried to do with the reinventing government and also what Bush tried to do with his presidential management agenda. And I do think you have many more specific ideas to try and back that up. But at the same time, to what extent would this build on those previous initiatives and to what extent would this be different?
So. Each generation kind of, it's funny. When I was here, we were just debating zero-based budgeting. Everybody has their own call. I think why this one is different from the past. I quite frankly, the others are so old, they're not being built upon. They're gone. All right? So there's not much left from either one of them. And the reason why probably there's not much left is they both began from a position of not respect for what they were beginning to enter into. Now, I love to work with wood. And if I don't sort of get into the project by sort of respecting the wood and what I'm doing, it's usually right when you end up with the 3-inch splinter in your hand. And, I think just the language of reinventing government. Now, I was part of the Clinton administration, all right? And God bless him. I love the man dearly. He was totally wrong on that. I think the reinventing premise sort of implied it was broken, that what we had wasn't working right. We're starting from the premise that we've got the best and the brightest. that we are amongst the most efficient agencies. You know how many people process and accurately pay the millions upon millions of Medicare claims and Social Security claims that are made, you know, weekly and monthly? 4,000 people for the entire nation. There is not a private sector company in the country that could put its nose on the line and say they do the same thing as well. So I'm beginning this not from a premise that it's broken, needs to be fixed. I'm beginning it with, we got the right people. I'm treating them with respect. That's the first rule. They need to be treated with respect. And then second, we've got to empower them with systems that will allow them to go farther, faster. And so that's where this is kind of coming from and why it's a different tack. I think the vocabulary is different. I think the approach is different. And I hope the results will be different because of it.
Thank you for your time. I'm wondering what the biggest transition challenge you think you will face is and how you will lessen that challenge.
As I mentioned in the speech, the system right now is not like it's going to break next year, all right? It's not like it's a crisis. And in America, as many of you know or you will learn, Americans quickly rise to a crisis and are pretty slow to react to a problem. And because it's not a crisis, the biggest challenge we face is inertia. In that there are people who say, well, I kind of like what we got now. I know how it works. And what you're talking about is different. And it may be better, but it may not. And a lot of times people tell me things will be better, and they don't end up that way. And so thank you very much. I'll just stay with what I got. And that is the biggest challenge that we'll face. And it will come not just from employee and labor. It will come from managers as well. And a good case in point on this is, it's so funny, be careful what you complain about in life, right? For 25 years, I complained about the Office of Personnel Management. And there is a hand of justice in the universe. It will come and get you. And when I was doing that, it was funny, when I was at the zoo, I always used to complain. I would go to my HR manager and I'd say, why can't I have the best qualified pool of candidates? You're only giving me three candidates, the top three. And he says, oh, OPM requires that. So I'm like, okay. So I get to OPM. The first thing I do in the first meeting is like, what the hell is this rule of three? Why do we require every agency to have rule of three? They say, oh, we abolished that in 1984. My HR guy just had never let go. He was used to doing it by a rule of three, and by God, he's going to die doing it by a rule of three. And that's how people are. And so the biggest challenge we have is to, without creating a crisis or creating hysteria, is to say, look, this isn't going to last forever. While we have good people of good faith, let's take a crack at fixing it, and we'll see. So it remains to be seen whether we'll succeed.
Mr. Berry, thank you for your time. I wanted to ask actually about the issue you brought up about how public servants are often maligned, attacked by, you know, whether they're political groups, politicians. And it seems that one group that is being attacked a lot these days are intelligence officials. And I'm not sure, like, what OPM's, you know, jurisdiction is within that. But for those of us, you know, we have a national security program here, and some of us are interested in getting into that field. What's being done to kind of respond to those attacks or alleviate them just for those of us who are interested in a career in that field?
I think it's a great career to pursue. It's a great field to pursue a career in, and there are a lot of really good people in it. I think the best thing to be done in terms of responding to this is having Leon Panetta there as the head of CIA. You also have in Denny Blair a phenomenal leader at ODNI. And these are two of the best and the brightest. Rock-solid integrity. Universally respected on both sides of the aisle. And they are working hard to convey the message that their people are working hard to protect us and our security. And, you know, that doesn't mean there's not reforms that need to be put in place, that there's not special precautions that we could add that would make things work better. The bottom line is you've got great leadership at the top. And where you've got great leaders, you can trust to be engaged and involved. They are agencies that do phenomenal things, and they do incredible work, and they need to be there. Because, unfortunately, it is a real world. And there are bad people in it. And we need to protect ourselves from them. And those leaders, along with all of us, need to speak up and defend all workers who are putting their lives and their families and their fortunes on the line. You know, the key difference in the intelligence agencies that is different from both the military and from civil service is your neighbors know what you do when you're in the civil service, and your family knows what you do when you're in the military. But when you're in the intelligence community, sometimes you're doing it just for yourself and your country, and your neighbors and your family won't know. And there's an extra burden on that community that they have to rise and assume, and we need to be extra respectful of that, because that's hard. Imagine, you know, being at the Christmas table or at the family celebration or the wedding, and everybody's saying, well, what did you do last week? And you got to kind of say, I was in hilly territory, or something. You know, you're making up things that it's tough. And that's a real sacrifice that community makes. But I hope you'll continue and think about it as a career. It's a great place to be, and they've got phenomenal people there.
I guess I outed myself then by asking that
question. As the senior LGBT official, I'm also out too, so in a different way than the intelligence community.
To Mr. Berry and to the panel, thank you for being with us this afternoon. You somewhat addressed this question earlier, but I'd like to ask how the performance ladder avoids the inertia that you're trying to reverse through preferencing of experience through the way that it's tiered, as opposed to how does it balance out bringing in the brightest and best thinkers, regardless of a level within that?
It's a good question. I wouldn't presume that everybody has to start at the apprentice level. That would be a natural track and a natural course. But let's say if Dean Wallerston wanted to come in and work at the State Department for 3 years, obviously he shouldn't be paid as an apprentice. But here's how we would keep that from being cronyistic, or, you know, so that there would be some standard. So it wouldn't just be because, oh, well, John Berry hired Dean Wallerston because he went to Syracuse, which people would say. So how do we solve that? We that same review board that reviews somebody coming from journey level to the expert, what if that same review board, if we were going to bring him in as an expert pay level, had to convene and review that and approve it? So not John Berry is deciding the dean's salary. The review board is, and is saying, yes, he merits this and has proven this and is worthy of the expert rating. So I would see this system as flexible in that regard. You wouldn't have to start at the apprentice, at least as, and I'm raising these as ideas, not as things I have locked on that I want to do yet. But it could work in that way.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Berry, in terms of the review board and the fear of like cronyism, how much weight would you actually put on the assessment of your peers? Like how much weight would, as opposed to like outside experts and management?
That's the devil in the details. That's why I'm sort of putting this out here in the public now, inviting thought and comment on this, and meeting with your professors and meeting with all of you, is so that, and it's, this will be in the Washington Post tomorrow, too, so you can read about it there. I'm putting this out there in an attempt to invite discussion, because I have not gotten into that level of detail. And I'm not even willing to say this is the way. I'm saying this is one way. Anybody got a better one? And, how would we do with that? So I don't know. I guess I would pose the question to the group. What would be a fair composition of a review board? Should it include your peers at all? Should it have people outside the agency or not? Should it have labor unions and managers? So I don't have the answer to you because, you know, we're sort of, this is a new approach and we'd have to wrestle with this. And that's why we're putting it out there to get input.
All right.
My name is Arpita Khare. I'm government official from Government of India, civil service official. Just wanted to know, like, do you have any, like, scheme so that international collaboration can take place? Like, I'm from Government of India and I can serve U.S., something like that. So that we can learn something and contribute also, whatever we have experience in our country.
I think it's a great idea. I have met with a number of HR leaders, and I've spent some time with the head of for the European Union from Australia, and I have not gotten to meet from India yet. But I think it's a brilliant idea, and we all have discussed this, is how do we do this in a way that obviously security issues and others, but at the same time benefit from an exchange that we could garner by around the world sharing expertise with each other and learning from each other. And so we do need to create a program that does that. I have not, there's so much on the plate at this beginning phase that I've sort of put that on the outer cycle. But that doesn't mean if somebody's got a good suggestion that we couldn't pull that forward. So if you have some thoughts or ideas on that, send them to us.
Yeah. India has got a very robust civil services system, and I think, a lot of experience we can share.
That'd be great.
That.
Yep. And the same, you know, Great Britain also sort of was in, and they had some ideas. But even there, it was, how do we do this in such a way that, it might work and all the details get worked out? But I would welcome your thoughts and input on this, because it'd be
a great
project.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Hi, my name is Caitlin Connolly, and I'm actually in Professor Kim's Human Resource Management in the Public Sector class. And we hear a lot about private sector personnel policies and innovations that are adopted by the public sector. And I'm wondering to what extent you see this as an opportunity for OPM and the federal government's personnel policies to sort of set an example for other sectors and innovate and maybe have, implement some policies that might sort of spread around to other sectors. And in what areas?
Our strategic plan, if you go on our webpage, is pretty short. It's novel. We put it out there for public comment for a month on our website, inviting anybody to talk about it. But the goal is for the United States government to be the model employer for the country in the 21st century. And in that capacity, I mean leader in all fields. And it was at one point. Much of the human resource practices that the private sector uses today are modern emulations of federal practices of the past century. And so they're outgrowths. Now the private sector, because the federal government essentially stopped growing at a certain point, the private sector has gone way ahead of us. And so I've met with Google and Facebook and IDEO and a number of other innovative companies, learning from them as to how are they wrestling with these issues. And some of these thoughts that you heard today are kind of an amalgamation of that input. The goal, though, is, as I told them, okay, Google, you're number one now, but we're going to give you a run for your money. And my goal is to take the title away from them. So we're going to try, and that's going to be the game. But we can do it by sharing and being open and being innovative about it. But, we can be the model workplace. We can pioneer and demonstrate some of these ideas. If we can crack the issue of performance appraisal, trust me, it doesn't just help the government. It will help every private sector company on the planet because nobody has figured this out. If we can figure out how to create flexibility in pay but still have fairness with it? Again, nobody's figured it out. Google told me that they just spent, I was with Laszlo Bock, who's their head of HR, and he was telling me, he says, we spent something like $30 million creating a pay and appraisal system, and they're throwing it out. They're not happy with the results. So, this is something everyone's wrestling with. It'll be fun, I think, if nothing else, as we try to craft a new way. But our goal is to regain that leadership title.
Thank you.
Hi. This is actually a question about collective bargaining in the federal government. So as you seek to sort of transform the federal workforce, do you feel that your hands are tied at all by the last 20 or 30 years of collective bargaining agreements and promises made to workers over the last 25 or 30 years? And how do you reconcile what you are obligated to do under collective bargaining with what you seek to do in the future?
I am a strong proponent of collective bargaining. I really think it produces great solutions. We are strongly urging that the president support an executive order reestablishing collective bargaining partnership councils throughout the government. And so we're going to be working on that. How I'm proposing to deal with this is by talking with them up front. How I have always worked with my unions in any agency that I have been at has been to say to meet with them and say, look, anything can be brought to this table. Doesn't mean the answer is yes, but everything is fair to discuss here. And my goal is to create a workplace that is respectful and it solves problems. And you all are going to know problems a lot of times far ahead of what managers are going to know. And so any manager worth their salt is listening to as many different sources of information as they can to identify early warning system on problems. If you have good partnership, you hear about problems before you read about them in the Washington Post. And you have a shot at solving them before they get into the paper. And so I don't see, there's nothing in the past 30 years that's been negotiated with a labor union that would prevent any of the ideas we've talked about today. It will require sitting down and working with them. Why did NSPS fail at the Defense Department? There are a lot of reasons. We could spend another hour discussing that. But one reason, without question, is that it was rammed down the union's throat and it was not discussed with them in an open and honest way. My commitment that I've made to every union leader is nothing is going to be rammed, that we will be working hand in glove, discussing fully, transparently, and welcoming their input and thoughts from the very beginning of this. And so that's going to be the spirit we move forward.
Thank you.
Hi. Actually, my question is a bit of an extension of the previous two. In all of the way of talking about the changes that you're interested in making from, say, five different interesting titled levels that you could be at to three, I'm wondering qualitatively how that would necessarily differ since it's still maintaining a hierarchical structure while trying to cultivate more of a learning community, more of a community where people are actually not competing against each other, but sort of, you know, working together towards a named project. So that was my first question. The second one, too, was as far as your employees, how are you coming here is terrific. I love it. But as far as your employees, not your managers, what are the ideas that they've given as far as looking at merit and looking at appraisal systems? Have you implemented any sort of structures to be able to get an honest sort of back, you know, feedback as to how they might envision a more fair and just having worked there?
Absolutely. Well, part of that is the discussions with mm-hmm. labor, is a direct discussion with employees. But also we're opening up, and as I said with our strategic plan and others, we're pretty transparent. I have a monthly staff meeting that's just like this, no holds barred. No holds barred. So anybody can ask me anything, we can discuss anything, we can build on that. All of the initiatives we're doing, we first go out and survey our employees and say, any suggestions, any thoughts, what do you think? This one, what you all are hearing tonight, you're the first to really hear this in a united way. What this represents is 7 months of me listening to a lot of different folks, employees, managers, private sector, everybody. And as I told the Washington Post, what we're doing here is putting this sort of essentially running the flag up the flagpole and seeing what comes down. It may be shredded. It may be torn up. It may be totally, they may blow the flagpole away. This is an attempt to begin a dialogue that's going to be an ongoing one over the next couple of years as we try to build a straw dog that we can propose as an administration initiative to reform the civil service. I did not propose an initiative tonight. I began a discussion. And that discussion, since it's going to be in the Washington Post, in Joe Davis's column, is read by every federal employee. You're not familiar. It is read by every federal employee in the federal government. And so by doing that, it's a specific attempt to put those ideas out there to invite the comment.
I guess I just often wonder, having worked in the public sector for a long time, how the flag feels as it's being pushed up and then dropped free fall, how the flag pole, and oftentimes the concrete below the ground, how what they are thinking or feeling or seeing, or how their different perspectives add to it. And I often wonder how effective the structures we use actually give us what those people are thinking. So
I invite,
if you get anything out of that, I would love to see
that. I invite ideas for how to do it better. And we always are on the lookout. I like I challenge you to take your team idea and tell me how that might work in the federal government. Not, you know, necessarily here tonight, but to think it through and send me an email on it. I will read it, and it will get considered. I am not pretending that I have the answers here. I have to admit to you, it sounds a little kumbaya to me, but I'm willing to try, and I'm willing to listen, and I'm willing to explore. All right?
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming today. I have a question that is really burning in my mind, but I really hope that you don't find it inappropriate, but I think that it's germane to the discussion. Performance review panels and political appointments, to me, they don't seem in tandem. And I guess I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on that? Because, with political appointments, obviously, they come from the top down. Performance review panel, something that has to do with ascendancy from the bottom up.
The civil service and the notion that's really what these reforms are about are 98 to 99% of the government. OPM is a good example. We have 6,000 employees. We have 20 political appointees. All right? None of us kids ourselves. Who's running the agency? You are working with those people. You're making, you essentially get to make some of the key policy calls. But the work of the agency is done by the civil servants, and it provides the continuity of the government. And so politicals will always be there, and they need to be, because that's, at the end of the day, how our democracy works. You do empower people to come in, and elections matter. And different people get to make different calls. So, for example, on domestic partner benefits, during the Bush administration, somebody went and testified on Capitol Hill and said, how do you know, Mr. Director of OPM, that this isn't going to create fraud? He says, it will create fraud. You all saw that movie, Chuck and Larry. Well, that's the, when I went and testified, a very different presentation was made. Elections matter, and positions matter. But the bulk of the work, the day-to-day work, the processing of retirement checks, making sure people are paid accurately, making sure that when they retire, they're treated respectfully and that things are happening quickly, that's the work of the civil service. People get their Social Security checks, veterans being treated in hospitals. All of that's done by career people. And so we need to design a system that is responsive to their unique needs as being careers, being there for a career. Politicals come and go, quite frankly. The average tenure is 2 years. And so, the political system is never going to be the driver entirely. On a system like this, And the pay of the political system will be underneath this, as it is today, in that only the cabinet and the president really exceed the civil service margins. Most of the senior executive service in the career make more than me or any of our political team, as it should be. So, I think, and politically, that's how it's going to always be in the country. No one's going to have the guts to reverse that.